and a very warm welcome to you on a grey London day. This is Midori House, live from Studio One, and I'm Nancy Durham. Over the next hour, we'll check out the dailies across the Asia-Pacific region, find out what's making the silver set smile in Berlin, and talk with our man in Tehran about a mini-tourism boom there. Monocle editor Andrew Tuck will join me later as we listen in on a debate about television. To watch or not to watch, that is the question. First up on Midori House, the news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
This is Monocle 24 News. I'm Nick Kelly. Eurozone leaders struck a last-minute deal to contain the currency bloc's two-year-old debt crisis, but are now under pressure to finalise the details of their plan to slash Greece's debt burden and strengthen their rescue fund. After a summit in Brussels, governments announced an agreement under which private banks and insurers would accept 50% losses on their Greek debt holdings in the latest bid to cut Athens' €360 billion debt load to sustainable levels. Economists polled by Reuters today were split down the middle over whether the write-down was big enough, with 24 of 47 saying it wasn't and the remainder saying it was. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso says he's confident the plans will work.
The package we have agreed tonight confirms that Europe will do what it takes to safeguard financial stability. I've said it before and I'll say it again, this is a marathon, not a sprint.
Rescue workers have pulled out a man alive from the rubble more than 100 hours after an earthquake that killed more than 500 people in eastern Turkey. The man, who was rescued in the town of Erciş, the hardest hit by Sunday's 7.2 magnitude tremor, was whisked away in an ambulance to the cheers of onlookers who witnessed the rescue. Today, a 5.4 magnitude quake has struck an area south of Sunday's quake. A serial child killer and paedophile already in jail in Northern Ireland for three child murders was convicted of murdering a fourth girl today, 30 years after she died. A jury in the town of Armagh found Scottish-born Robert Black guilty of murdering Jennifer Cardy, aged 9. Black denied guilt but did not take the stand to defend himself. He was sentenced to life imprisonment. Tens of thousands of Thais leaving Bangkok today caused traffic jams by trying to escape to the south and east. Thailand's Prime Minister said that Bangkok was fighting the forces of nature as floodwater threatened to burst through dikes protecting the capital. Evacuees leaving the capital said they expect the situation to worsen. Tourist Claire Taylor and her friend are planning to leave.
We're both starting teaching placements. So mine doesn't start till Tuesday, but we're going to leave early because of the floods. We're a bit scared.
And finally, back to Europe and a smile exchanged by French and German leaders about the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi brought more frowns today, with Berlin denying his claim that Chancellor Angela Merkel had apologised. Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy swapped a smile when a questioner asked them at a news conference at a European summit yesterday if they were reassured by Berlusconi's promises of action to address Italy's deep economic crisis. The smile caused widespread resentment in Italy, where it was seen as a national humiliation and insult. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. Well, a smile really can get you into a lot of trouble, I think, now and then. Let's have a look now worldwide at the worldwide weather with Tomasz Szafernaker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And in Europe, the weather stays mild with a mixture of sun and rain as far as the computers can predict. In France, the temperatures on Thursday between 15 and 20 degrees, even in Germany up to around 17. Now with this mild weather comes a price, and of course it's the rain. We've had quite a bit of rain. More rain to come from Spain into western France, and of course, you guessed it, into the UK as well. Some of the best weather conditions, however, through the rest of Thursday and into Friday will be across central and eastern Germany. And the good news is that as we nudge into the weekend, the weather should improve in other parts of Europe as well. So the business forecast then for Thursday into Friday, and Berlin, morning mist and fog followed by some afternoon sunshine, 14 degrees the high here. In Paris, after today's sunshine, showers coming tomorrow, warm at 18 Celsius. In London, damp and cloudy for the next 48 hours, 14 Celsius, a real grey autumn scene here in London. And in Madrid, passing showers and around 15 degrees. Now, if you're flying onto Spain and Portugal in the next 48 hours, a lot of heavy weather en route due to a weather front affecting the very west of Europe. Also a jet stream in the vicinity of this weather front, so bound to be some bumpiness. If you're flying further out into central Europe, clearer and calmer weather at around 30,000 feet. Across the Atlantic, bumpy weather likely as you fly around the British Isles and then again over parts of Canada. Now over to North America, and there is some snow on the way for the very far northeast of the United States, also into Ontario and Quebec. This is for Thursday night local time there. Further south into New York City and New Jersey, it's mostly rain. Meanwhile, still very warm across the southeastern states. How about the Pacific side in California? Looking sunny as far as the eye can see, really. It's a great climate here in California. Now, the Business Center forecast for Thursday and Friday, New York City, wet on Thursday, followed by a sunny Friday. Temperatures here in the region of 12 degrees. In Chicago, it'll be sunny, 12 Celsius. In Miami, sun and a few clouds, 30 degrees Celsius. And in Los Angeles, 22 degrees, sunshine and more sunshine. I cannot emphasize that enough. A great week on the way in Los Angeles, and even sunny into next week too. Now, air travel. Okay, so the next 24 hours in the northeast of the US with the rain and some snow could be a few delays here, but really it's just a bit of snow, so shouldn't be too big a deal. Heading out to Europe from JFK, perhaps bumpy over eastern Canada, and then quieter across south of Greenland as you head into Europe. And finally, a quick update on Hurricane Rina near Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Through Thursday local time, Rina will be impacting Cancun, known location, the effects, torrential rains, and of course, very strong winds. So some damage in the area is on the cards. And then over the weekend, Rina could be heading to Western Cuba. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljati, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House. Well, as we've been hearing all day long, after mountains of suspense, Europe's leaders finally reached an agreement on how to save the euro and Europe from ruin. Well, in short, the solution is to have the major lenders write off half the debts owed by Greece. Enter Finland. As our northern friends have a bit of a reputation as problem solvers, Tyler Brulé thought who better to turn to in moments of crisis than the Finns. Well, earlier Tyler talked with Finland's Europe and Foreign Trade Minister Alexander Stubb on the line from Helsinki.
Mr. Stubb, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Over the last year, Monocle has been talking a lot about Finland's pragmatic approach to all kinds of things, whether it's education, whether it's approach to defense, and certainly when it comes to foreign policy. What can Finland teach the rest of Europe? From your point of view, you're shuttling back and forth between Helsinki and Brussels. If you could impress upon a few points to us, what would they be?
Probably the first point is that we are not very good in the teaching business, in the sense that we don't want to tell the rest of the world how it should be. But there are a couple of characteristics that I think define Finns. One is what I call an honest handshake. Finns might be a little bit humble, a little bit shy, but when you shake a hand, you know what you get is what you see, and what you see is what you get. So the Finnish handshake, I would argue, is very honest. You can trust the Finn, and I think trust is a wonderful virtue and a wonderful value in today's world. The second one is that we're pretty good at brokering compromises. So, if you have a war somewhere, or if you have a conflict between companies, or if you have a familial conflict, or anything, I think the Finns are quite good at sort of taking a non-nonsense neutral approach and saying, okay, let's fix this. So we're pragmatic folks.
And on that note, if we can look at what's happened in Brussels since midnight, it's great that we have the semblance of a deal. But of course, without wanting to tell your European neighbors and cousins what to do, maybe it's a bit of gentle Finnish persuasion. Are there any Finnish lessons that can be learned, any advice when it comes to managing one's pocketbook, deep pocketbooks, and also one's bank accounts?
Well, surely there is. I mean, I myself have a big mortgage, so who am I to talk? But our government's actually doing quite well. I think what happened in Brussels last night pretty much symbolizes what we Finns are about. In other words, we're quite tough, we're strict, we stick to our public finances and the budget. We don't want to live over our means. I'll give you one example. There are three countries in the Eurozone that fulfill the so-called Maastricht criteria right now of debt and deficit. They are Estonia, Luxembourg, and Finland. So this means that we have kind of, I would argue, the moral authority or the moral right to try to craft future European rules to a more stricter fashion so that this never happens again. And that's exactly what we've done. We haven't come out and said, listen, you must all do like we do. But we've come out and said, listen, we've stuck to the rules. It would be quite good to have a system whereby everyone would do the same thing. And it's a way, very Finnish, strict, pragmatic way. Don't live over your means. When you're doing well, save. When you're doing badly, use that money.
And Mr. Stubb, how much is that a social code then? I mean, this is what's interesting because, you know, when you are a country like Finland and you are quite a homogenous society, you know, and many would say, you know, not particularly diverse, which of course has its good and its bad sides. You can mobilize Finns very easily. So, you know, is part of it also a social code where it's quite difficult in, let's say, a more diverse society to mobilize people in the same way to say, okay, everyone, now it's time to save and now it's time to spend?
Yeah, probably it is part of the Finnish psyche and it's part of the social code. And it's probably part of the northern way of life as well. In the olden days, if you didn't save, if you didn't store, and the winter came, you know what happened? You died. So it probably sits in our gene pool that we have to somehow, you know, stock up and make sure that we can cope over a long winter. And that's the type of a life that most people here in Finland lead. Does this mean that we're not living over our means right now? No, it doesn't. We're actually trying to cope with the debt crisis much like anyone else. But it's much easier to push these things through here in Finland because people understand that, okay, now we've lived over our means, let's save up so we can balance the budget again.
Let's just look over the horizon. All going well, and as you said, we've had you know, a decent resolution over the last 12 hours out of Brussels. At least it moves us in the right direction. From a Finnish point of view, both internationally, but certainly just within the Eurozone as well. You know, what are the marching orders for the country right now? Many have said, well, okay, look what's happened to Nokia. And, you know, this is, you know, it's quite unfortunate because this was the entire engine for the country. Now, that's, of course, an external view. But what would you say to the rest of the world? Is Nokia your only trick in Helsinki or in the whole country?
Oh, not at all. By the way, I guess I shouldn't be doing any product placement here, but I love the new Nokia, and I've never had another phone, and I'm going to stick to it.
Well, you'll be happy to hear that we have Marco Attasari on the program later today anyway.
Marco is fantastic, and I think the N9 phone that he designed with Migo is great, and I think the new Lumia 800 is fantastic as well. So there you go. I guess I can say that as a trade minister. But no, Nokia is not our only sort of string to life. Finns have always been traders. You know, we started with fur, and then suddenly we went into tar. We live in such harsh winter conditions, one could argue, and with a certain lack of natural resources, if you take wood out of it, that we have to survive, and we do it through trade. 40% of our GDP is trade, 50% of our tax income is through exports. Now, in the 1990s, when we hit a real rut and a recession, Nokia came along. We put money into research and development and coped. Now I think we need to focus a lot on startups and new industries. I think Angry Birds and Rovio is a wonderful example of that. So we have to keep on reinventing ourselves all the time in Finland, and I'm sure we've done it. And I've always argued that internationalism, trade, openness, liberalism, they are the basic oxygen that Finland breathes. We don't survive without it. And I would also argue that we were a little bit limited in that field in the 1970s because of the political situation being next to the Soviet Union. But once the shackles of the Cold War were sort of unfolded. We opened up. We became members of the European Union. And I would argue we went from a top 30 country in the world into a top 3 country in the world. So a new Nokia will come along, or Nokia will reinvent itself as it seems to be doing. So I'm not worried at all.
And just before we go, do you think that young Finns, when you look at the next generation, do they dwell just within Europe, or do you think that they also, go to Vanta and they also, very much look east towards China, Japan, Korea, and all of those places and all of those routes that Finnair seems to be plying?
I hope that all young Finns will be globalists. This means Finns, Scandinavians, Nordics, Europeans, Westerners, but looking eastbound. Because we can, of course, see the gravity, I would argue, of the world, both economically and otherwise, moving eastbound. And I'd just love to see every Finn visiting, for instance, Shanghai, as I did last week, and just see the dynamics of the place. We always joke around and say that everything is big in the U.S., but it's actually big enough in China and in Shanghai. You might have your opinions of the system, but everything right now is both big and modern.
Wonderful. Alexander Stubb, thank you very much.
And that was Finnish Minister Alexander Stubb talking earlier today with Tyler Brulé, who is with me now. And what a delight Mr. Stubb is.
Isn't he a firecracker?
He is a great talker. And let's bring on the Finns and put them in charge.
Yeah, I've always believed that what we should be doing within the EU is just dividing things up, because not everyone is great at various sectors. So let the Finns look after education. I'm happy for Mr. Stubb to maybe take a bigger role in Brussels. I would leave the Italians in charge of food policy. But maybe they can take a back seat when it comes to other things. I'm not quite sure what we'll let the British do, but anyway, we can come back to that.
Compromise, a handshake, and such a clear talker.
Yeah, no, he's great.
And the social code. I mean, you're right. You understand these people.
Yeah, well, I think we sort of understand Finns as Canadians, don't we?
I think so. We love their city.
We love Helsinki. It was our number one city this year in terms of livability. And it's interesting, because from other corners of the world, whether it's Australia, whether it's the United States, whether it's elsewhere in Europe, people say, oh, but Helsinki, it has harsh winters, it's dark all the time, etc. But there's a lot of payback in terms of, I think, not just cultural institutions, but you've got this wonderful outdoor environment. Fair enough. I mean, you can only use it for 4 hours, come December time. But you can use it all night. You can use it all night in the summer.
You are listening to Monocle 24 Radio. I'm Nancy Durham, here with Tyler Brulé. I'm going to keep him around for a few minutes. After this, we look at the stories emerging as morning breaks in Asia and Australia.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter till Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 no chican des.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Monocle 24. I can't do that, can I really?
No. You can if you want to.
But I love it. I love the sounds of those voices. Now, our team has been beavering away all day looking for all the things that are making the news in the dailies, the headlines in the dailies across the Asia-Pacific region.
Yes, they have.
And they've assembled a fine collection,
definitely.
Gaggle of stories here.
This is what's making news this morning across a variety of titles all over Asia. And there's actually quite an interesting piece from the China Daily, which this will be good news for our friends at Nokia, Mr. Stubb. Giving a little bit of a plug for one of his country's big brands. China's mobile phone users will hit 952 million. That's what it says when they get the final tally for the month of September, which is just absolutely enormous.
Staggering.
It says China's 3G mobile phone users reach 102.46 million by the end of September, the statement said. Quite significant.
Who's making them? Do we know?
I mean, there's a number of big players, but not oddly enough, but Nokia, because they have a number of entry-level phones as well. They're a big player in the Chinese market, so that'll be very important for them. This is something out of the Straits Times of Singapore.
Yes, I was going to go to that one.
Sorry to beat you to it.
That's okay.
I haven't seen this, this is actually from the AFP Wires, but it says North Korea is refusing to let 200 of its workers. So of course, North Korea had a number of people working in engineering positions, etc., in Libya. It says it's not allowing them to return because it fears that they will spread word about the fate of Muammar Gaddafi. And that's according to what Leon Panetta was saying on Thursday. Mr. Panetta told reporters he got the information from South Korean defense officials during his current visit to Seoul. I don't know what they're going to do with them. So anyway, there's 200 North Koreans for hire. I wonder who let them in.
Fear of unrest.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll kick them out.
Yep. No,
that's an amazing story. Wouldn't you like to spend some time with them? That alone might make them be a little bit unrestful.
Yeah, well, exactly.
India. There's an interesting story out of India. I'm sorry to report that the AFP in Mumbai is saying that the country's richest are 20% poorer than they were in 2010. This is due to factors, they say, including inflation, falling stocks, and corruption. The source is Forbes magazine. But I did hear today that India had its first real Slumdog Millionaire winner. Did you catch that bit of news earlier today?
No, I missed that.
Lovely man who wants to build a new house. He won $1 million, and he wants to buy books. He loves to read, and now he can buy all the books he wants.
Hmm.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. Here's some bad news for smugglers. That Australia's striking customs officers. They've reached a pay deal. It means that the Beagles or Basset Hounds, I'm not quite sure what they use at Aussie Customs, but they're very strict. I remember once upon a time when I was going into Australia and you're filling out the customs and immigration forms, etc. And then my mom was bringing all of this Estonian Christmas food with her to Sydney because we rented a house up in Palm Beach for about 3 weeks. And so as we were going through, my mom said, should I say anything about this? And I said, well, I think you just leave the stuff on the plane because I said they're
dogs.
They're pretty severe. Of course, mom got busted, right? And then they said, they said, excuse me, ma'am. They said, did you not read the forms? This is a federal offense in Australia. But my mom said, yeah, but I made them myself. So she goes, I thought if they were store-bought, she goes, I couldn't bring them in. But these are homemade.
Did they let her keep them?
They let her keep them.
Did she give them a taste?
No, I don't think she'd give them a taste.
Didn't go that far.
No. But anyway.
Love your mom.
Mom didn't go behind bars for that. So anyway,
So they did have a little bit of a strike.
They
there
did.
Was a moment for smugglers to get through. And now that window is shut.
It's firmly closed now.
They need other doors. So another story from the Aussie end of things. There's some work problems here. 4,000 Qantas baggage handlers are having what they call stop work meetings. I can picture that today.
Right.
and they're unhappy at the airport.
They are. I mean, there have been myriad problems with certainly on the transport infrastructure side. Julie Gillard, the Prime Minister, has been furious with all of the industrial action that surrounded the country's flag carrier, particularly at a time when a lot of people are wondering what type of brand Qantas is going to be, what type of airline does it want to be, when it is flying the flag for a country which has been doing reasonably well so far economically, but is also seen, not only has been challenged of late by the likes of Cathay Pacific and Singapore Airlines, but it's been the Arab carriers, Emirates and certainly Etihad and Qatar, who have all given them a bit of a thumping. So I think many Australians would like to see Qantas come back with a bit of a, not just an Aussie spirit, but a fighting spirit. But it's not great when you're having stop work meetings.
No. But they seem to be coming, do they think they're having some sort of, there are appeals from politicians to get in there and get it sorted.
Absolutely.
What else do you spot? There are other Australia things. There's Jakarta.
Well, we can go to the Jakarta Post. It says power company will only buy coal from clean and clear miners.
Right.
Now that's quite funny. Now clean and clear miners. Do they actually mean that the miners themselves should be clean and clear?
I would think so.
Yeah.
Because how could you count on the coal being clean and clear if they weren't?
Exactly.
Definitely. Yes, I'm with you on that.
Interesting headline. The Asahi Shimbun this morning is reporting that the yen's new highs in Japan could derail Japan's economic recovery. The Bank of Japan's decision on October 27th to spend an additional 5 trillion yen, that's $65.9 million, buying bonds on the open market, pumping it more money into the economy, came against a background of a growing sense of desperation at the damage being caused to Japanese industry. Also, the Asahi Shimbun today reporting that Toyota goes green in an effort to help the Fukushima recovery. This is interesting. It says that Toyota Motor Corporation plans to build a hydroponic vegetable plant in Fukushima that will not rely on soil to grow greens.
Because hydroponic does not grow in soil.
Yeah, it's like this type of philanthropic effort is quite interesting because I remember some time ago, I mean, I met some designers and engineers from the special Toyota lab who were you know, living in their own special version of the future, and then they were telling me that we were all going to be driving around in seaweed cars.
Seaweed cars.
Yeah, you have to go with me on this. But
looking
it was,
forward.
Yeah, these people, they do live 30. They live 30 years in the future. These people.
Love it, Tyler Brûlé. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks,
this
Nancy.
Half hour. Pleasure to have you. Obviously. next, we are going to be off to Tehran. That's after this.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programs you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download Monocle's first app, featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 25/25 City Guide series. With its unique timeshift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and I am Nancy Durham, here with you till the top of the hour, soon to be joined by our editor, Andrew Tuck. But first to Tehran, where we reached our correspondent by telephone a little while ago. Monocle's Jason Rezaian has his eye on Iran's attempt to resuscitate its tourist industry. Jason, give us the business, if you will, on Iran's expanding tourism industry. What's going on there?
I think we have to look at it in terms of history. And for over 1,000 years, Iran was probably one of the top two or three destinations of any explorer in the world. And it's just the last 30 years or so that that people haven't been visiting here as much. But the fact is that Iran, from a day-to-day perspective, has always been a very safe country. And there's quite a lot to see. There's over a dozen UNESCO World Heritage Sites here. And the United Nations World Tourism Organization recently named Iran in the top 10 in terms of tourist potential in the world. But the revenues that Iran earns from tourism each year is down around number 70 in the world. So there's this huge room for improvement, and I think the government is starting to recognize that this is a place where they can really focus some attention and earn literally billions of dollars in revenue each year that they've kind of been ignoring for the past 30 years. So it's just a matter of common sense that this is money that they need to start generating.
So a safe place, some top attractions, but a country with a difficult image, I think we could say.
They've worked on it kind of stop and go over the years, and I think now that there's more of a push, especially from some of the members in President Ahmadinejad's administration to really expand on how Iran markets itself to the rest of the world.
I'm having a hard time squaring this with the fact that Iran is a country under sanctions. The International Atomic Energy Agency will soon be releasing a report to say that it's further down the line towards producing nuclear weapons. You know, and you paint it like a lovely little holiday. It seems to me to be quite a contradiction.
I think it is a country that's full of historical value, and while those concerns are definitely real, welcome foreign people into their country. I think that's one of the great things about visiting Iran is that people are still so surprised when a foreign person would visit, because while they feel comfortable on a day-to-day basis living their lives here, they realize that the rest of the world has this image of them as kind of living under very oppressed conditions 24/7.
Do you think there's any chance that this rather small influx in visitors can have any effect on the political situation there and an opening up of society there?
Yeah, I think it can have a great effect on it. I think coming here and seeing the realities of life in Iran, experiencing some of the sort of more mundane or benign aspects of life here, and then coming back to the U.S. and sharing that with friends and family is really important aspect of, if you want to call it citizen diplomacy. I think this is a perfect case of that. And I think in some ways we can look at how Americans visited Cuba in the late 90s and in the early part of this millennium and had some decent traction in terms of how American policy was affected. So yeah, I think it can make a big difference.
Jason, what music have you got for us today?
The song is called Hame Kare, which I guess loosely translated means jack of all trades. And it's a fun song about a young man that does everything.
Is the music scene really, really alive there now?
There are concerts that take place, not very often, but the recordings are widely available. In Iran, there's no copyright laws here, so sharing of music happens very quickly, and I can say, from my experience with underground musicians here, very few of them are actually in it for the money. So they just want people to hear what they're doing. And so, I think there's a big music revolution happening in Iran right now.
I'd really like to know what it's like to be you there. What's it like to be a journalist in Tehran?
You know, it's a very difficult question for me to answer because it changes every day. But just before we got on this call, I had a phone call from the foreign press ministry. We get those calls sometimes, and sometimes they're asking us to come in to answer to something that we supposedly did, and other times it's an invitation, as the one I just got was. But every time you look at your cell phone and you see that number come up, your heart kind of drops. 90% of the time, it's nothing. It's definitely not the easiest job in the world, but I love it because I'm in a situation where I'm able to look at a situation that very few people in the West have access to and try and make sense of it. In that regard, I feel a big responsibility, but I also feel the situation is a big open canvas and I can write about many different topics, and that's what I choose to do. I cover the news, but I also cover society and culture, and I kind of feel like I'm disseminating information from a faraway planet. And that's kind of fun.
Jason Rezaian, I just love your passion for your job. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Our correspondent in Tehran. And dear listener, I have to say I'm sorry we were unable to bring that tune to you. It just wasn't quite up to Monocle 24 standard. Okay, coming up in the next half hour, Andrew Tuck will be with me as we talk about a classy German supermarket. And we'll tune in to our TV debate. But first, here's Nick Kelly with some news headlines. Nick?
Thanks, Nancy. Eurozone leaders struck a last-minute deal to contain the currency bloc's two-year-old debt crisis, but are now under pressure to finalise the details of their plan to slash Greece's debt burden and strengthen their rescue fund. A 5.4 magnitude earthquake has struck southeastern Turkey 4 days after a more powerful one killed more than 500 people. It's being reported a US drone strike has killed five commanders of one of Pakistan's most influential Taliban leaders. Kenya's Red Cross says gunmen have attacked a civilian vehicle with rocket-propelled grenades and machine guns, killing 4 people. It happened near the Kenya-Somali border. The US Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says he's skeptical about talks with North Korea. A meeting between the two countries in Geneva has failed to arrive at any agreements. The Philippine Army Chief says troops have killed 4 communist guerrillas in a clash in a northern province. Soldiers, aided by sniffer dogs, are pursuing the New People's Army rebels in Cagayan. Egypt released American Israeli Ilan Grappel today in exchange for 25 Egyptians jailed in Israel. And finally, Pope Benedict acknowledged today that Christianity had used force in its long history, but said violence in God's name had no place in the world today. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Well, this is week 2 of Monocle 24 Radio, and life has forever changed here in Midori House. Hasn't it? Andrew Tuck, who has just joined me in here. Are you having fun?
Yeah, I'm having fun. I'm sleeping in the office these days.
I think there's more than one of you who might be in here.
Yeah, I think we need more showers because people are getting a bit grubby, I think.
But it is Monocle 24.
What did that mean? Yes, 24 hours. 24.
Yeah, so
yes.
That means you've got to be here and at the ready.
Yeah, I know. Don't tell me off.
No, I'm praising you.
I'm signed up.
I think it's fantastic.
I'm with the program.
I think that's great. And I'm so glad you're on the program with
me
today. Welcome here. I hear lots of people are listening to us. They're downloading this podcast.
Yeah, but I think more people are listening to The Urbanist.
No, Midori House.
No, apparently The Urbanist is now the most downloaded show in Britain.
Anna, could you bring down the Andrew's microphone in there for a minute? No, it's great. People are listening to all the programs, and that is very exciting.
Yes, especially The Urbanist, yes.
Excellent.
No, it's listening to everything. I hear Midori House does very well when you're on it.
Oh, you are too sweet. And then with the two of us.
I know.
Okay, stop. People will be ill soon, won't they?
Now, can I just, were you a bit offended? I was a little bit offended when I suddenly realized why I was dragged into this next section.
Well, I was just looking at you as far as I can in the beautiful, you know, kind of sexy lighting in here. I don't see your hair turning gray, though you're working all these hours.
That's in the nice dark light in here. Turn gray. Because actually first when I thought, because we're going to be talking about the silver set.
Yes.
I thought I was going to be asked to talk about cutlery.
Yeah, me too, or a tea service or something.
Yes, and then I heard about old people.
And do you know, well, I'm out of date with my politically correct style guide. You're not allowed to say elderly, and that's for like 2 years. But, so silver set is the new...
2 years ago, they banned the term, did they?
I think so, two or maybe even 3 years ago.
Because I thought it was a bit weird that Tyler Brulé came down for the bit where he could talk about dogs. And he got very confused about his dogs, didn't he? Because you wouldn't have a basset hound in searching for drugs.
I don't think you would.
It's like a poodle looking for drugs. It's just wrong.
We'll have a dog.
And then when it comes to kind of grey hair, he does a runner.
He's out of hair.
Yeah.
And leaving it with us.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be associated with the grey hairs.
Where are you going to take us with the grey hair? Well, actually, I know. Well, I can't pretend that I don't know.
But. We're going over to Deutschland because the Germans are making life of the silver set a little bit more comfortable these days. Germany, possibly the world's oldest country on earth, has raised the bar when it comes to silver set shoppers. Kimberly Bradley, our eyes and ears on the ground in Berlin, has been sampling the aisles of one of Kaiser's new supermarkets. And she talked with Nancy a short time ago.
Kimberly, take us down the aisle of Kaiser's, if you would.
If you walk into this particular branch of Kaiser's, there are many throughout the city, but this particular one is meant for older people. And if you walk in, the peripheral aisles are extra wide. The lighting, and you don't notice this at first, is very bright, but it's not fluorescent. And the floors are non-slip. And these are not things you necessarily notice. You just notice an open, pleasant, almost American-style supermarket.
So you don't even think elderly people, really.
Not
it's
at
a
all.
Nice atmosphere.
Exactly.
What gives the game away at some point that it is?
There are small little clues, for example, magnifying glasses hanging at the end of each aisle.
I could use those.
I could use them as well. There are little signs that you see from time to time that indicate that a certain product is good for a single household. And a lot of older people are single, but a lot of young single people live in the same neighborhood. So it's meant for both old and young. And they have a special cart that was designed, I believe, by the Kaiser's people that doubles as a seat. So you have a small shopping cart, you can put a brake on and sit on a little ledge on the cart as a seat. And a lot of older people, I have observed them using the carts this way.
Oh, that's like turning the trolley into a bit of one of those walkers. You know, my mom pushes a walker along and needs to rest every now and then, and she's good again.
Yeah. And the people actually use it this way. There is a Seniorenheim in German. Old folks home is what we call it, I guess, in the States, a nursing home, across the street from this branch. And you do notice quite a few older people using the cafe and just shopping here.
Do you know what prompted Kaiser's? Well, I mean, obviously, they've got the senior citizens across the road. They want to do business with them. But did something happen to get them, you know, like really thinking this way and really acting?
I think it was just a response to the clientele. And the older building that had been on that site was ready for renovation. And so they took a really good long look at the demographic that they would be catering to. They actually, in researching this a little bit, there was one other supermarket in Austria called Adeg that did something similar, and that kind of, with some of the smarter supermarket chains, set off a bit of a chain reaction. This was all about 3 or 4 years ago, but there's more and more of this kind of thing happening.
It's catching on.
The German-speaking world, yeah.
And the silver set shoppers, what do you talk to them? What do they say about this?
They love it. Oh, they absolutely love it. I talked to two or three people. I did a print piece on this a while ago, and I talked to some of the shoppers, and they very much appreciate the magnifying glasses. They appreciate the fact that there's a step near the dairy case. It's just easier
for
them to make.
I need that. How many of us need that, right?
Short people need it, exactly. Help, no matter how old they are. Yeah. And they like the fact that there's a cafe, because what was missing in the... They have a place to meet. Or once they shop, they can meet each other and have a coffee before they... You know, a lot of older people are single or they're alone. You know, their spouses have died.
Yep.
They absolutely love it.
You say, you know, this is sort of... It's spreading a little bit in Germany, next door in Austria. Are there other designs or phenomena like this happening around you where you can see designers are starting to think, you know, creatively and thoughtfully about the older generations?
You mostly see it with infrastructure, and this goes two directions. It's made for both older people and people with kids. A lot of the old subway stations in Berlin are being retrofitted with elevators or with more easily navigable steps. Things were a bit treacherous in the past few years, especially with the old East German infrastructure. That I think is a combination of just people making things easier for everyone, and it includes the older set. I don't see it, let's put it this way, I don't look for it, but I think a lot of things are geared toward older people, and I don't see them so much, just like Kaiser's. It's very subtle.
How nice is that?
That's wonderful.
And also and in a place like this, you're bringing in, you know, the young mums and kids next to the grannies and grandfathers. What a, you know, it's a lovely mix.
It is a lovely mix. I appreciate it because I have a small child. Never noticed how much easier things can be with good design.
It sounds wonderful. How profitable is it? Is this good business?
So far, yes. When Kaiser's opened up their generation market, sales were 25% above forecasted figures, which was a surprise and indicates that this is a very good sales model.
No wonder you see them increasingly around you.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Kimberly
Bradley in Berlin.
Thanks.
Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? I'm a little bit worried about the step near the dairy counter.
But I sometimes sneak up right on that counter in the grocery stores here. Not on the counter, but you know there's a little bit that sticks out. And I sort of, when no one's looking, I make sure my shoe's clean and I just get up there to reach the cheese or something that's up high. So what are you worried about?
Well, I'm worried they might tumble into the dairy counter.
Like old people climbing up. I mean, silvery people, other generation people.
But I think what is the genuinely interesting thing is that when you look at somewhere, even like London or in the big cities, that there's so many older people who don't want to kind of be moved out of their homes, to move out of the city centre. They're healthier than they've ever been before, and they lead much more active lives than people did 20, 30 years ago. So actually, you know, although it's great that these supermarkets are catering for them, I think there's a ton of really older people who live in our city centres. What's interesting, they do live quite, you know, active, ordinary lives. And I wonder whether you really do need, like they have done it, to build it next to an old people's home, that there's where you've got a really kind of congregated area of senior people for it to be a success.
You'd have to kind of be a fly on the wall there, wouldn't you? I mean, I have experience of old people's homes right now with my mother living in a senior citizen's, you know, retirement apartment building. And I think a lot of people do need help. And I'd say most of the people she's neighbours with are on these walkers, which are now actually amazing, all-terrain vehicles they are. They can go flying across the field, practically. But I think they do really appreciate the width, you know, to get through bathroom doors and all of that.
Yeah, but I think wide aisles are good anyway. So I think if people...
Yeah.
We just did a story on the new Waitrose supermarket, which is here in Canary Wharf, and it's their state-of-the-art supermarket. And they've deliberately kind of widened the aisles, just, I think, to cope with numbers, really. So I don't think wide aisles particularly is for kind of old dears, is it? Actually, I think narrow aisles are good if you're a bit older, because then you can stumble
sort of
on one side and stumble.
From hang on to the soup tins and then the other side.
Over to the beans.
Work
yeah.
your way down.
Yeah.
Or for people like... Anybody, really.
Yes.
Okay, well, we do thank Kimberly for that. And I want to remind you that you are listening to Midori House here on M24. In a moment, the Monocle TV debate.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download Monocle's first app featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 25-25 city guide series. With its unique time shift device to spool through programs, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Monocle 24 broadcasts around the clock, 365 days a year, from Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, London W1. An independent media company, Monocle 24 is part of Win Content, with bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York. Monocle 24's editors are Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield, Gillian DeBias and Paul Noble. In addition to our own news gathering network, Monocle 24 uses the services of Reuters, Sky News and the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. For more editorial and advertising information, please visit monocle.com/24.
And indeed, this is Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham, and I'm not alone.
It's me, Andrew Tuck. I'm with you all the way.
I'm so happy.
Thank you. Well, there's been an interesting story in the papers this week which said that younger people, that includes you and me, Nancy, I think, younger people are turning their backs on the television. They do watch TV programs, but they watch them downloaded onto their laptops these days. And they don't actually want to spend any money on buying a TV set. And if they were forced to give up a piece of electronics, they would give up their TV set quicker than anything else. They said they want to keep it on their phone. So we asked around the office, and we found there was actually a divide in our office between the pro-TVs and the anti-TVs. So we asked, we had a bit of a debate off. And first of all, it's Rob Bound, who's going to make the case for having a telly.
You know, last week when I said that TV was radio's flash git brother, well, he still is, but he's made it, hasn't he? He's sorted. His shirts might be bolder than the test card, and he might wear too much gel in his hair. His manner might be mock Tudor, but not even his triple garage is drafty. And anyway, the Bentley Turbo has a cashmere coverall. You might not like his glittery game show curtains, or the dance floor he's had put in to replace the library. You might not like the fact that he's had the fireplace ripped out to accommodate a 78-foot telly, or that he's eaten the old money herd of deer on the estate and replaced them with safari beasts of varying docility. He can always buy new windscreen wipers for his wife's Range Rover, can't he? And have you seen his wife? So kids aren't watching TV on TV these days? They'll come round. People that don't have TVs aren't interested in life. Show me someone that believes themselves above TV, above it all, that feel their good taste and worldview is misunderstood, who are themselves too interesting to watch the box, and I'll show you a moody teenager who can't afford a big TV. A bloody big, brilliant telly where life lives and your dreams are answered in colour. Show me someone without a TV, and I'll show you someone boring. Were you going to curl up in front of the fire this evening and read an improving Victorian novel by candlelight? Of course not. In today's rain, were you going to visit that challenging new gallery that lies out where the night buses sleep? Pull the other one. That talk you never went to, the one with the novelist and the scientist arguing about God and fiction, that was on Sky Arts last week. I watched it in high definition, in the warm, drinking a glass of Meursault on my sofa, without a woman in wet tweed, or at least I think that was the smell, sitting next to me in a cold lecture theatre. Where's the theatre in that? I saw you squinting at some men in suits on the little screen on your little phone, but I couldn't see if it was a meeting of the G8 in Paris, or the new episode of Mad Men, because it was bad and breaking up, and it was so, so small, your screen. Choose life, choose a job, choose a career, choose a family, choose a fucking big television. End quote.
Ooh, oops, I didn't know that was coming, but thank you, Rob Bound, for pushing the boundaries of radio. Now it's over to Hugo MacDonald, who has better things to do than watch TV.
When I come home after a day's work, the last thing I feel like doing is staring at another rectangular box, however flat or plasma or high definition it may be. And I don't think I'm alone in being turned off by the idea of watching TV. Being glued to a laptop for the majority of my waking hours is enough backlit screen gazing for me. But what of all that wonderful programming I'm missing, you might ask? Well, the problem began for me when I found myself switching on and being moronically content to watch crap. Hours would get sucked away watching the most minor celebrities do the silliest of things. Wife swap, find boyfriends, masturbate pigs. Curiously mesmerising, but stultifying too, and definitely not educational or enlightening. Though I was able to join in with water cooler chat the next day in the office, increasingly I wondered if precious evening hours could be better spent in the company of others, or reading, or listening to the radio whilst folding my underwear. There's too much on TV, and too much that's too bad on TV, and it's too easy to get sucked in. So I switched off. And I'm pretty sure I'm a better person for it. For one thing, I never fall asleep in a neck-achingly horrid position in front of the box, waking with a fright at 4 a.m. in the morning to see some permatanned old dear flogging cheap jewellery. The rare moments of quality television that I do miss, such as a good grilling on Question Time or an unusually polished TV drama, I watch on my laptop at a later date and from the comfort of my bed. So if I do nod off, I don't have to wear a neck brace the following day. And one of my favourite liberations from being TV-free is that my living room is no longer geared to the ugly grey box in the corner. It's a depressing development in home decor that the TV takes pride of place in most people's front rooms. And the bigger and flatter they get, the more prominent they become. Giant portals to a world of whinging celebrities learning to dance and going on cringy journeys of self-discovery. No, my life is complete without the box. And now that I'm free from its grasp, I'm finding real life better than it ever looked on reality TV. I'm cooking, cleaning, reading, and thinking more. And the radio in the background is far better company than the gruesome grey panel in the corner. It also means I'm folding my underwear almost daily. For Monocle, I'm Hugo MacDonald.
Well, it's nice to know all about his pants, isn't it?
I know, his underpants. I'm trying to figure, do you suppose he folds them in half, or does he put the crotch up and then put the sort of wings in?
Or does he actually roll them and tuck them in? Because you can do them like serviettes as
you
well.
You could do rolling, but he did say fold.
Yes, so he did say fold.
Makes you want to look in his knicker drawer and see how it's all arranged.
I think you should better put on the TV, right? If you've got that much time, you're at home alone, folding your knickers of an evening. Set. Put the telly on.
Put the telly on. Now, I have a great big flat widescreen, and it does dominate, Hugo, our sitting room. And my husband and I are nuts about Downton Abbey. And we missed an episode last week. And, you know, there we were, the two of us, Monday night, sat on the couch with my little iPad, which I just got. And we watched it there, just like that in front of us. And, you know, I didn't miss the big screen. But so, this is a kind of non...
So you might rip out the big screen?
No, I do love to be able to watch my movies and special dramas and a bit of news on the telly. But it was amazing how this little device was fine. A beautiful resolution.
But it is interesting for TV makers that actually there is a big shift. You know, when you ask around our office, perhaps half of the people don't own a TV. I think they're just too cheap. They don't want to pay the license fee myself.
Or maybe they're just saying that because they think it's
no,
cool.
I don't think they do have a TV.
Do you have one?
I have two.
And do you watch?
I'm not very good about television. I watch like two things. I watch Mad Men, which I like.
I loved that.
And I get slightly addicted to rolling news, even when it's bad.
I know, especially when it's bad, actually, in a way.
Yeah, nothing happens, but I keep on having to look, thinking something might have happened, and it normally hasn't.
Mad Men hasn't come back on again, right? You're talking about...
No, because there was some dispute about salaries, I believe, and that it delayed for a long time before they made the programme again. But so it is coming back.
It's coming back, and I will not miss. I've seen it all. I've caught up with all of it, but I'm... Maybe in the new year?
Yeah, I believe it's in the new year, but... It's just, for me, it's like one of the perfect pieces of drama because it's something actually happens during it. It's interesting.
Okay, so who wins the debate, may I ask?
Well, I think Rob, to be honest. You see, I like Hugo, but he does get a bit strict about these things. I mean, when someone's so strict, the headmastery about it.
I kind of liked that way about him.
Yeah, but I want to rebel.
He doesn't sway me. I do want my television set. I've got two of them. Two big, flat, wide screens.
And although he kind of describes this beautiful life of being at home, reading books and improving himself, I've been to the pub with him most nights.
Well, there you go. And all this business about the undies.
Yes.
He might regret writing about that. I have a feeling this is going to come back to haunt him now.
McDonald's knickers. He'll rue the day. But anyway.
I think we do have time to go off in a little bit of a different direction. Earlier, you noticed we passed on a tune from Tehran, although we wish the Iranian musicians well. But this gives me a chance to plug my fellow Canadian, Jason Collette. He's a Toronto-based singer-songwriter, and I just can't get enough of him. Here he is with Roll On Oblivion from his 2008 release, Here's to Being Here. Jason Collette from Toronto and Roll On Oblivion. So there's a little contribution.
I liked it.
Good.
It's probably a little bit easier on the ear than something from Tehran, I think.
Yeah, I hear they were playing bluegrass in Tehran.
Actually, there's some amazing music scene in Tehran, and there's a really interesting record store there that's survived literally since the 70s, and the guy kind of manages to get kind of bootlegged and copied versions of songs and of albums and CDs, and he's done it through for years and years and years, and it's the one place that people still go to, you know, you could buy Michael Jackson there when Michael Jackson was a big star, you know, whoever's a hit in the West, he gets versions of it for you.
Oh, nice.
Very nice. Yeah. But you know what's even nicer?
I can guess. I bet it's got to do with the show that's coming up after this one.
Well, because you know,
a show that's almost as good as Midori House.
Yes, because around the world people are gathering.
Oh.
Ready for the urbanist. So shall I tell you a couple of things?
I'd love to know. Tell us what's coming up.
Well, there's the story by Aisha Spears, who in New York went to meet a man who has ambitions to build a 13-acre underground garden in Manhattan, which will be built in the tunnels of disused tunnels of the subway station. Then there's also our wonderful Kenji Hall, who was he's done a story for me about how you plant 1 million trees in a city. So Tokyo wants to build 1 million trees, but they don't really have anywhere to put them all. So they're slightly running out of places.
Thank you. Keep listening. That's all from us here at Midori House. We thank our producer Jillian DeBias, studio manager Anna Veal. Nick Kelly's going to have news headlines for you over the next few hours. And then at 2200, as you heard, it'll be Andrew Tuck.